78, they begin adding up to the seventh story of the tower, and they tried to compensate for the lean that it already had with only three levels by building the floor, the levels a little taller on the short side. And they stopped because it began to sink and lurch to the south by as much as 3 feet in 1278. In 1370, they finished the eighth floor and installed the bell tower. And by 1550, the tower was out of plumb and leaning to the south 12 feet. In 1934, Mussolini, and I know some might remember him. In 1934, Mussolini thought that the leaning tower was a poor symbol of the masculine fascist Italy. And he began through a project to drill holes and pour 200 tons of concrete in below the tower to stabilize it, which caused it to abruptly lurch more to the south by several inches. In 1964, the tower found itself leaning 17 feet to the south. They had already in 1950 locked the big heavy medieval bells in the tower so that the swinging of them would not cause any more problems. But in 1964, it was leaning 17 feet to the south, and the Italian government asked for solutions as to how it could be corrected. And over the next few decades, off and on, some attempts were made in the 60s and the 80s to drill some holes to try to maybe do something to pour more concrete in or level it out or maybe make it sink a little bit the other direction. But all of these made the tower lean even just a little more. Finally, in the mid-90s, tendons were attached to the tower and counterweights pulled it back 1 inch. In 1999, the late 90s, the tower was closed to any public visitors because of fear. And in 1999, a very meticulous process of excavating the soil beneath the tower as little as a gallon or two a day started. By 2001, this very meticulous process, coupled with massive cables holding the tower so that in case there was a sudden displacement, it wouldn't just lurch and fall over. But these massive system of cables was attached. The little bit of soil was extracted little by little. By the end of 2001, after 2 years of slowly excavating this soil, the tilt had reduced by 18 inches. The Italian government reopened the tower to tourism, thinking that those 18 inches probably bought them another 300 years. So sometime in the next 300 years, go visit the Tower of Pisa before maybe it falls over. Problem solving. Problem solving is what we're talking about this morning. Our text is John chapter 6. And just like these folks who were in charge of the Tower of Pisa and those who have dealt with it for the many years since had to solve a problem and attempted to solve a problem, well, in John chapter 6, Jesus, really not so much Jesus, but the disciples of Jesus thought they were confronted with a problem. This, interestingly enough, is the account of the feeding of the 5,000, and it is the only pre-resurrection miracle that is included in all four accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It is the only miracle other than the resurrection. It is the only miracle before the resurrection that is included in all four of them. The problem is stated in verses 1 through 5. Let's read those together. John 6, beginning at verse 1. After these things, Jesus went over to the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Then a great multitude, keep that two-word phrase in mind, great multitude. A great multitude followed him because they saw his signs which he performed on those who were diseased. And Jesus went up to the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes and seeing, and there it is again, a great multitude coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" We learn from the parallel accounts in Matthew, Mark, and Luke that it is a desolate place. Matthew 14, verse 15 tells us it is a desolate place, like a wilderness. Mark chapter 6, verse 31 tells us that even Jesus and his disciples, because of their schedule and they were so busy teaching and dealing with the people, even they, Jesus himself, did not have time to eat. And so they were hungry too. And not only were these men hungry, but they realized they had a great multitude that was hungry. And all four accounts stress the large number of people who was there, which eventually we learn is 5,000. And we are told in Matthew, not including the women and the children. We know there were children there. We'll talk about that a little later, and particularly tonight. But we see that they had a bunch of hungry people. And as you keep reading in the text, they find out that they have 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, which would equate to 1 loaf per 1,000 and 1 fish for every 2,500. This just wasn't going to work. I mean, that was just enough food to feed a hungry little boy. One time when our oldest son Abram was in his early teens, we went to CC's Pizza, and he ate 17 pieces. I was afraid they weren't going to let us come back. I mean, I was worried about him, you know, what it just had done to him, but I was worried they might not let us come back. But little boys can eat a lot, you know, and this was enough to feed one hungry little boy, but not 5,000 people. And so they had a problem. And from our text this morning in John chapter 6, we're going to think about problem solving, because we see from the text there are 4 possible solutions. The text will suggest to us 4 possible solutions to the problem. Let's examine each one of these solutions and make application. Solution number 1. Matthew 14:15 and Mark 6, verses 35 and 36, tell us what solution number 1 was that was proposed by the disciples. Send the people away. That was proposed solution number 1. Send the people away. So often, this is the way we try to deal with our problems, isn't it? So often, this is the way we try to solve our problems. We want to send it away. We want to ignore it. We want to avoid it. We want to send it or give it to someone else. Because after all, if it's away and we don't see it, we're not thinking about it, it's not our problem anymore. If it's out of my sight, I don't have to think about it. And if I don't have to think about it because it's out of my sight, I don't have to solve it. And so that was their solution. It's late. We're out here in the middle of nowhere. There's not anywhere these people can eat. Just send them away. But Jesus said in Matthew 14, verse 16, they need not go away. I really don't think that was the answer that the disciples were expecting to hear. I think that answer was the first of 2 or 3 things that Jesus said that perplexed them more and more and more. But here are all these hungry people. They know that Jesus knows it. They know it. All the people know it. And their proposed solution, just get rid of it. Just get rid of the problem. Get rid of the issue. Here's how to solve it. Just let somebody else handle it. Send it away. That's what we do. But Jesus said, Matthew 14, 16, they need not go away. In other words, Jesus said that is not the solution to the problem. As we think about a little bit of application, we see that Jesus does not send problems away. Aren't we thankful? Even the big ones. Jesus does not send problems away. Our sin. Big problem. Thank God, Jesus did not send us away. But instead, Jesus said, they need not go away. To you and me, Jesus says, you need not go away. Jesus did not send us away. Jesus did not ignore us, avoid us, or think someone else should handle us. Jesus does not send problems away. We as His disciples should not either. I know we can't necessarily solve everything. I know we don't necessarily have the ability to do everything that needs to be done. And sometimes we wish that we did. But we need to at least take the example of Jesus, and when we have the opportunity, to help those that we can. Galatians chapter 6 verse 10 says, as we therefore have opportunity, let us help those who are in need. I'm paraphrasing that just a little bit. But let us do good unto all men, especially those of the household of faith. Galatians 6 verse 10. As we have opportunity, we don't always have the opportunity, we don't always have the resources or the means. But when we do, let's not send them away. Jesus doesn't, and we certainly see that Jesus did not send us away with our great problem of sin. Solution number two. That one didn't work. So solution number two. When we look back at our text in John chapter 6, verse 7, Philip, let's back up to verse 5. Philip said, where shall we buy bread that these may eat? And this was said to Philip by Jesus. Jesus asked Philip the question, where will we buy bread that these may eat? This he said to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. And that's speaking of Jesus. We'll loop back to that before the lesson is over. But in verse 7, Philip answered. Now here's solution number two. Philip answered, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that everyone may have a little. 200 denarii would be roughly two-thirds, three-fourths a year's salary in that day and time for the common day laborer. Solution number two proposed by Philip was throw money at it. We can solve it with money, so throw money at it. Now, he did quickly say, we don't have it, but throw money at it, because that could be the solution. The variation of this would be we don't have enough money, because he said 200 denarii, that's just not sufficient. But if we had it, it still wouldn't be enough. And the solution to the problem that basically is being proposed here is that if we had money, if we could throw money at it, if we had the resources, we could solve the problem. We have seen that this is often the solution proposed by our government, isn't it? If there's a problem, we'll just budget it and we'll throw some money at it. And we'll keep throwing at it year after year, decade after decade. Often that does not solve the problem. And Jesus was not looking for an answer that involved money here. Jesus knew that the answer to the problem was not money. As true as it can be at times, as helpful as that can be at times, we must realize that money is not the ultimate solution to our problems. We must realize that money is not the only answer or solution to our problems. If you look back in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus reminds us of that, doesn't he? If you look at Matthew chapter 6, begin reading, if you will, at verse 19. Matthew 6, verse 19, Jesus says, do not lay up for yourselves. Remember, the solution is not money. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust corrupt, and thieves do not break through and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. He continues to reinforce this, if you would, beginning at verse 25. Matthew 6, verse 25. Therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or what you will drink. That's exactly what they were worrying about over in John 6, wasn't it? Do not worry about what you're going to eat or what you're going to drink or your body, what you will put on. Is not your life more than food and your body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, for they neither gather nor sow nor reap or gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of much more value than they? Which of you, by worrying, can add a cubit to his stature? So why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I say unto you that even Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these. Now if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? Or what shall we wear? For after all these things the Gentiles seek, or the pagans really is what he's meaning, for your heavenly Father knows that you have need of all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. You see, solution number two proposed in John 6, throw money at it, is not the real solution. It's not the real answer. And so, as you continue in our text, we now see solution number three. And solution number three involves one of Jesus' disciples named Andrew. When we come back to our text in John 6, we begin reading at verse 8. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there is a lad here. I told you we'd talk about a young boy. There is a lad here who has five barley loaves and two small fish. But what are they among so many? Proposed solution number three, uncertainty. You and I have all been there, haven't we? We've all had problems. We've all had issues. We've all had things we were thinking about, and we were trying in our mind and rolling around how we could solve it, what we could do about it, how we could approach it, and we kept coming back to one answer. And what was the answer? I don't know. What do I do? You've been there, haven't you? What do I do? Well, here's something, but I don't think it'll work. It's inadequate. It's too small. It will not meet the need. And Andrew, for as admirable as he is in at least trying to do something, I mean, you know, give that man a quarter. He was trying. Or a denarii, I guess I should say. He deemed his solution, though, too small and of no help, just like we often deem our own solutions and our own answers too small and of no help. And so we become discouraged. And our solution really drags us down because we think there is no solution. But again, at least Andrew was trying. And he was acting on the words that Jesus says when you look at the parallel in Mark chapter 6. In Mark chapter 6, after you know the disciples say, we don't have enough food, send these people away. Jesus said, how much food do we have? And in Mark 6:38, Jesus says, go and see. At least Andrew did that. At least Andrew took Jesus at his word and he went to see. And this is what he found, but he says, what? I don't think it's going to do the job. I really don't think this is enough to help. Sometimes we have to see the smallness of our own solutions and perhaps even the silliness. I mean, it's almost laughable, isn't it? 5 loaves, 2 fish, 5,000 people plus women and children. Sometimes we have to see the smallness and perhaps the silliness of our own solutions to open up our minds to other possibilities. That maybe there is another answer out there that I haven't thought of yet. And maybe I'm thinking too small. And maybe I have painted myself into a corner that I shouldn't be in. And that there is really a solution there. And sometimes we have to see our own inadequacies and our own smallness and our own smallness of abilities to open our mind to these other possibilities, other people, and to challenge our faith. That's exactly what Jesus was doing with his disciples. Go back in John 6 and read verse 6. After Jesus asked the disciples about where can we find the food to buy for these people, look at what the next verse says. This he said what? To test him. Because he already knew what he was going to do. You see, Jesus wanted the disciples to see that their solution was small. Jesus wanted them to realize we can't solve this by ourselves. Jesus wanted them to realize that they needed to turn to someone greater and something greater. Jesus. And sometimes we need to see how small we are to then begin to see just how big our God is. And so that brings us to solution number 4, the true solution, Jesus' solution. Once they have found the bread and they make Jesus aware of that, verse 10, Jesus said, make the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down in number about 5,000. Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise of the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they were filled, he said to the disciples, gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost. Therefore they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves, which were left over by those who had eaten. Here's the true solution. The disciples had a physical solution. Number one, send them away. Philip proposed a physical solution. Throw money at it. Andrew proposed, or was at least resigned to, a physical solution. Now here's some bread, but what can we do with it? Jesus initially appears to give a physical solution because, after all, what does he do? He turns the physical bread and fish into a multitude enough to feed a multitude. He meets a physical need. Jesus initially appears to give a physical solution, but as we keep reading in the text, it was really intended to be much deeper. There was much more to what Jesus did, the true solution, than just the physical. Remember, we already have seen that Jesus did all of this as a test of faith. A test of faith. And that ultimately it was about faith and spiritual discernment. So listen from the text, and I'm just going to pretty much just read some verses from the remainder of this chapter that show us how Jesus is really giving a spiritual solution, the true solution. Listen from the remainder of the chapter as he unfolds the true solution. He himself makes application and he implores those who hear him to understand and obey. In John 6, verses 22 through 24, it says, a day has passed since these events, and the multitude is still seeking Jesus. John 22 through 24. In verse 25, we read, when they found him on the other side of the sea, they said to him, Rabbi, when did you come here? Jesus answered them and said, most assuredly, I say to you, you seek me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. You had a physical, material benefit, and that's all you're still looking for. Do not labor for the food, verse 27, do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life. There's the contrast between the physical, the material, and the spiritual. Do not labor for the food which perishes, but labor for the food, look for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set His seal on Him. If you would, move down to verse 32 in the chapter. Then Jesus said to them, most assuredly I say to you, Moses did not give you bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is He who comes down from heaven and gives you His word. Then they said to Him, Lord, give us this bread always. And Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. This is the solution. It's not about something material. It's about something spiritual and someone spiritual. I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. And I said to you that you have seen me and yet do not believe. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and the one who comes to me I will by no means cast out. Skip down to verse 41. Then the Jews complained about him because he said, I am the bread of life and have come down from the Father, or come down from heaven. And they said, now remember the contrast here is between the material, the physical, and the spiritual. Then they said, those who were complaining, they said, remember Jesus is unfolding the true solution. He is illustrating and applying it, and he's imploring us to understand it and believe it and obey it. But the Jews complained, some of the Jews complained, because he said, I am the bread of life. And they said, is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph? And then what do they proceed to do? Make physical application after physical application after physical application. Is this not Jesus? In other words, an ordinary man, the son of Joseph, an ordinary man whose father and mother may know. How is it that he says, I have come down from heaven? They thought he's just material. He's just physical. He's just of this earth. There's nothing spiritual and heavenly about him. And so they were failing to understand and failing to see what it was that Jesus wanted them to see and to understand. Verses 48 and following. John 6, 48. Jesus once again says, I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, physical manna, and what? They died. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. This is not material bread. This is not physical bread. This is not what they had eaten the day before, digested, and now we're hungry again. Jesus said, I am the living bread. You eat of this bread, you will not only not be hungry again, you will live forever. And the bread that I shall give you is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world. Because Jesus was going to die on the cross. His body was going to be sacrificed. The bread of life was going to die to make all of this possible. The Jews therefore quarreled among themselves, saying, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? Again, they were seeing it with material, physical eyes. Jesus was trying to apply it with spiritual eyes. Then Jesus said to them, most assuredly I say to you, unless you eat of the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Jesus is not talking about cannibalism here. Jesus is not talking about literally eating his flesh and drinking his blood literally that was circulating in his body. Jesus was talking about a spiritual matter of consuming, digesting, taking in all that Jesus is and digesting that in my, not my stomach, but my heart and my mind. Because what I digest in my stomach will be gone within 24 hours. But what I digest in my heart and my mind will stay. Jesus says, I am the bread, and you must consume me, spiritually speaking. You must digest me and my teachings if you want to live forever. Whoever eats my flesh, verse 54, and drinks my blood has eternal life. And I will raise him up again at that last day. Sometimes these verses are read in conjunction with the observance of the Lord's Supper. Jesus is not talking about the Lord's Supper here. Jesus is talking about the way of life and the mindset with which we approach him and we apply the truths of the gospel to our heart and life. And he says, when you do this the way that I'm trying to tell you and the way that I'm trying to teach you, and you understand all of this, you have spiritual life. And you can live forever. Verse 56, for my flesh is food in... Verse 55, for my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. As the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so he who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread which came down from heaven. Not as your fathers ate the manna and are dead, but he who eats this bread will live forever. There's the spiritual meaning. There's the true solution. There's the problem solved. Beginning in